Aren't you a technology supplier looking for deal flow? Then you should try our new platform, Connect. It's designed to help buyers and brands find the best tech solutions to match their campaign requirements. It's free for buyers to use and for tech suppliers to set up an account and start applying to campaign briefs. Set up your account today by visiting exchangewire.com/connect or email us at info@thewirecorp.com.
An Ad Tech Podcast special focusing on the most important topics in ad tech and martech. Hello and welcome to this special edition of the Mad Tech Podcast, taking a look at the concept of private gardens. As everyone who listens to this podcast knows, privacy compliance has become the fundamental basis of the advertising and marketing technology industry, and it'll soon become impossible for brands and marketers to target users in a browser or mobile environment without explicit consent from the consumer because of the removal of third-party cookie tracking in browsers and also because of changes being made to device identifiers in both iOS and Android. Fueled by the need to build and own first-party data, publishers have restructured their business models to focus on logged-in users where possible, which gives them the ability to offer more relevant audience segments to buyers. So this leads us to our conversation about private gardens. What are they and how are brands and publishers using them? What does this new buying environment look like and what are the defining characteristics which make it valuable to both buyers and sellers? This podcast features some good old-fashioned working from home background noise, mostly construction and dog barking, so please listen with forgiving ears. Hello, everyone. Welcome to this week's Mad Tech Podcast special edition, where we're going to be talking about the emergence of private gardens, what they are, why they're important, and what value they add. So I've got three fantastic guests lined up to chat through this topic with me. Matt May, Senior Biddable Manager from Three. Hello, Matt.
Hello, everyone.
Welcome. We've got Phil Raby, GM UK from Mediarhythmics. Hi there, Phil.
Hello, everybody.
Travelled all the way back from, I want to call it the countryside. It's not the countryside, is it? Where did you say it was? Winchester.
Winchester, yeah.
Winchester, back to London, back to the big smoke. Welcome, Phil. And Danny Spears, COO from the Ozone Project. Hello, Danny.
Hello, folks.
I suppose what is sensible to start with is a little bit of a definition or an understanding of private gardens. And Phil, I'm going to come to you first. I think I'm sure everyone will have a slightly different perspective on this, but I'd like to hear it from your, in your words. What would you consider to be a private garden?
It's a good question, considering it's the title of the podcast. I think it's important to understand, I guess, the differences between a walled garden and a private garden. I think a walled garden, I think, for the listeners, as you know, is, you know, the likes of Facebook, for example, who have, you know, as businesses have typically let data in, but I think fundamentally and historically have always provided kept the value for themselves as well. So they don't provide a huge level of transparency around reporting or I guess the algorithms they use. They provide sparse information back to external platforms as well. I guess a private garden is slightly more nuanced in the fact that They don't share data as such, but they're more transparent. They enable learnings to be exported. They provide transparency around algorithms. They provide a decent level of data back to brands as well. And I guess as an example, a really good one in the UK is Channel 4. Channel 4 have their brand match product, so they have 22 million logged in users. They enable brands to and other advertisers to upload their first-party data, match it against Channel 4's own 22 million logged-in users, apply machine learning for lookalikes to find new audiences, and provide in-depth reporting and analytics back as well. So that's, a very brief overview about what our view is of a private garden, and I guess an interesting example in the UK.
So I'm interested to know, Danny and Matt, and Danny, perhaps we'll start with you. How familiar are you with private gardens?
I'm not sure that I'm familiar with the terminology, and that's perhaps because it's a new concept. But certainly in terms of the principle, it makes a lot of sense. The walled gardens being closed they're being controlled by individual organisations, as Phil has kind of laid out. And I suppose we are seeing that they are increasingly lacking interoperability. as they deepen their moats and build further their walls upward. And I suppose at the other end of the spectrum, you've got the open marketplace, right? Which is almost the antithesis, I think, of the walled garden. It lacks control. There's data flying about willy-nilly. And, therein lies the issue for asset owners, but also from a compliance regulatory point of view around personal data. So I think at Ozone, we're, very much aligned with the principle of a happy medium, something that exists in the middle that enables, marketer and publisher to transact with one another, but acknowledging the important role that trusted technologies have in enabling that as well. So there, I think, the benefit of that setup is that you've got a nice balance between control of assets. Of course, compliance is hygiene, but acknowledging the importance of interoperability.
Yeah. And so then, Matt, from a brand's point of view, I suppose first question, how familiar are you with private gardens? And then the second question is, maybe you've got an opinion about the value of this type of buying environment for brands. You know, there's a clear potential value for sort of using and applying first party data and making sure that you can execute that in a privacy compliant way. But, I'm interested to hear your point of view on what you think the usability of this buying environment would be from a brand point of view.
Yeah, so I mean, like the guys have said, private garden is a term that's emerged from the recent changes. It's a term now that I'm more familiar with as we explore it from a brand point of view of the changing media landscape. For me, a private garden is sort of is more transparency. We know the walled garden is sort of limited to a few of the bigger internet players. One's been mentioned, another one begins with G, and a private garden place feels like it's more open to more players. There's more transparency and the rest of it. I guess the intention of from my point of view, the intention of a private garden is meant to be a rival to the walled garden scenario, whereby vendors can band together, and that's sort of the way I'm seeing it as an alternative in the buying space from an advertiser point of view. I mean, as a brand and advertiser, ultimately we should be making decisions independently, and it's based on merit and performance, right? So, I mean, we're as a company like Three, we're lucky to have a range of partners that can help guide us through this process, obviously with our media agency, but also appreciating the fact that we're having conversations directly with other partners that, have potentially their own agenda. But ultimately we're, weighing up the pros and cons of going with one media supplier over another. And I think that this private versus walled garden space just still feeds into that conversation. Ultimately, it's not, it's less about looking at it as walled versus private for us, but more looking at the media buy-in on merit and performance.
That's sort of a topic that we've been talking about a lot as, the privacy environment has become more forefront in the media buying landscape, but also with the deprecation of, third-party cookies and identifiers in a mobile environment, is the growing complexity of the buying environment for brands and therefore the range of sort of partners that you're going to need to rely on to help you navigate your way through that. I suppose there's a couple of things here. The first is, it strikes me that a private garden is an opportunity for buyers and sellers to perhaps get a little bit closer together. So I don't know if you've got a perspective on that. And then also, Phil, in particular, I'm just wondering if you've got a point of view on that concept of assisting brands to navigate their way around the complexities, especially from a tech point of view, and if you've got some sort of experience of doing that with some of your clients.
Yeah, we do. I guess in terms of, navigating more so, how to build a private garden, I think is one that we're quite astute at. I mean, obviously from a functional perspective, I think, there's a number of solutions that can power a private garden, CDP or CMP, et cetera, from a privacy standpoint. I guess the more pertinent point that brands need to ask themselves, or the strategic question more so is, what do they build themselves and what do they buy, from a internal perspective, brands need to focus on, building their own offering and what does that look like? And from the data sets they have as a business, how can that support it? there's also the other question as well about, you know, how do they hire, I think, to sell, you know, the relevant, I guess, data or segments for that specific private garden. And then also internally as well, there's this element of data science, which has become much bigger within brands and publishers as well. I guess from an external point of view as well, brands need to think about, you know, selecting a solution that is flexible when it comes to onboarding machine learning and data science, one that's bespoke and can, I guess, fit around their needs and flexible in deploying use cases. You know, there's obviously the notion of the fact that they have to leverage, I guess, DSPs and ad servers as well, and any other MarTech tool that is related to that private garden. And then, you know, the other question on that technology piece as well, from our standpoint, is, you know, do you as a brand select a partner which is, I guess, in inverted commas, I guess more of a point solution or a solution for a specific problem, which is, you know, you've got the emergence of data clean rooms now, which, you know, there's a very strong player, obviously, in the UK now with an eye, which I have a number of friends at. Or do you use a solution that can straddle multiple points and one that solves a number of solutions all within one stack? That's fundamentally what we believe.
Does that sort of resonate with you a bit, Matt? Do you find that actually, you know, like Phil's saying, it's not just about, you know, it's not just about solving a problem, but it's about obviously the range of solutions that are available, but how on earth you select those depending on what your, you know, desired outcomes are and who's available, I suppose, to help you get your way through that?
Yeah, absolutely. And we've spoken about this previously. It's a navigation piece really for us as a brand to determine that. And there's a few key things at play, obviously. It's the payback and the means to exchange effectively. You know, what's the payback for us? Obviously there's areas we need to explore before that in terms of, you know, there's certain brands that probably need to overcome certain things around access to their own data and various other pieces. But certainly that tech conversation is such a vast one. There's so many different avenues you can explore. There's so many emerging solutions available that I think there's, I've said it before, the value sort of that people in my position in brands really that we give back to the brand is being able to navigate that marketplace effectively. Mm.
I was just going to add a point there as well. I talked about the notion of technology, I guess, for private private gardens, but I guess even from a brand point of view, so for yourself, Matt, as well, it's, you know, obviously private gardens are becoming more important. They're you know, becoming more prevalent, I guess, in the market, and not just in the UK, but other markets. But, you know, as a brand, I guess, as 3 Mobile, the more detailed the first-party data that you have as well, the more rich it is, the better results you will have, I guess, is working with a private garden. And I guess what I mean by that is sending customers generally is easy, right? If you've got an email address, you can send it and match it versus a hatched email. But sending gold or valuable customers already requires some sort of segmentation. So as a brand looking to work with, I guess, this notion of private gardens, you already need some sort of technology stack internally to be able to manage your first-party data effectively as well.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's what certainly I've had plenty of conversations with my peers, and that is a big headache for a lot of people. And I think that's the first step in this. Exactly what you're saying, Phil, is you know, cleaning up your house and getting it in order and being able to service something that is valuable, to be able to have those exchange conversations in the first place, to be able to go out to the market with something yourself.
Danny, the opportunity in this for publishers or from the sell side?
Massive. So I think that the world is changing, right? You know, I've got very mixed feelings around the moves that Google have made recently. I like the way Matt couldn't even bring himself to say the G words. How it makes him feel, I don't know. But, you know, Google have driven a wedge between privacy and you know, anti-competition thinking, and you know, they are doing that for their own gain under the veil of privacy. I'm absolutely clear on that, as is most of the market. Meanwhile, I think what this does do is put publishers and first-party data owners in a really interesting position, strong position to monetize their data. And of course, this happens, there's a couple of other things that are going on in the market. You know, the open marketplace already, third-party cookies are already running at 50%, which is, an interesting consideration. People don't really call that out. They talk about, addressability in the future. We should be clear, the horse has already bolted on that one. I suppose that is the reason why Ozone's invested really heavily to support marketers execute audiences at scale without friction. The challenge that faces both the publisher and the marketer is, mechanizing that and streamlining it. Another reason why we've invested heavily in technology, I think one of the reasons you see in every market, marketers increasingly, but also publishers working together to find ways to engage meaningfully with those on the other side of their fence.
Where does this place the open marketplace? And I guess where I'm going here is, are private gardens more suitable for certain types of buyers?
I think the importance of one-to-one connections becomes even greater where open marketplace falls away. I think we're seeing this is forcing all of these changes happening at the same time as forcing kind of an oil and water moment. An open marketplace, I think, is becoming increasingly questionable. I bet it was always that it would die. I don't think we've been surprised in the way that it's playing out to this point. And I think it does mean that, whether you're a data-rich publisher supporting marketers and executing against the publisher's data or a data-rich marketer, you need to ensure that you've got pipes in place with either your demand sources or your supply sources, depending on which side of the fence you sit on, through which you can execute those audiences. I think the only folk that will kind of remain outside of that are those that are kind of buying around the edges, that are happy picking up distress inventory and, kind of comfortable just using contextual targeting from a third party. But I don't think that necessarily exploits the total opportunity. In fact, I know it doesn't totally exploit the opportunity that's available through first party data.
You weren't lying about the building works noise, were you, Danny?
I'm worried we're going to open the room and the rest of the house would have disappeared.
It kind of sounds like it.
Yeah, apologies.
Don't worry, we like to keep it real. Matt, was there something that you'd like to add to that? And I guess I am interested in your point of view, definitely, about whether you feel that some brands will be better equipped, more naturally equipped to make use of a private garden environment. Phil, you'll have a view on this too, I'm sure. Matt?
Yeah, I mean, there has to be a common currency, right? So the real entry point for a brand of any size is going to be around what the size of the prize is at the other end, ultimately, from an advertising point of view. I guess for smaller brands, you're looking at the cost implications of the certain levels of tech required for access and various other pieces to getting things in order. So obviously that's going to be that's going to play a role in sort of how it makes sense for smaller players to work with media vendors and the rest of it and tech vendors. I mean, for larger players, obviously consider ourselves a larger player, millions of customers. The real sort of the key for us is definitely to be able to keep the value of the data on our end and minimize the sharing of that data beyond a set of elite partners, for want of a better term. So certainly I think it'll be back to Phil's point, obviously certain brands and advertisers will have certain levels of value in their data that is available, and I think that's going to play a key role. I think a larger brand like Three ourselves, we position ourselves as being able to almost strike better deals and better exchange and conversations and kickbacks in the market with what we have available.
Bill, have you got a point of view on that? And I guess what do we say to smaller brands or brands that are trying to sort of pull together their data assets and improve them? How do they get piece of the action?
I think kind of to echo the guy's points, I think it's obviously going to be more beneficial as a brand if you have a lot of data, and also as a publisher if you have a lot of data as well. I think on the publisher side, if you don't have a lot of data, then there's the notion of, I guess, the creation of alliances between multiple members. To be clear, on the private garden side, it doesn't just, publishers, retailers, I guess, can be private gardens in themselves. What I mean by that is, you know, grocers, so the likes of Asda's and Tesco's, they all have retail media propositions as well. That in itself is a private garden because they're packaging up data and segments and selling it onto, you know, P&G. So they're in a very, very good position. ASOS just did that recently as well. I think they're just about to launch their retail media proposition as well. So it's becoming more popular. Again, another private garden. I think if you're a smaller brand, and it's not even about being a smaller brand, it's about having, I guess, lower amounts of first-party data. P&G, for example, don't have a huge amount of first-party data because they don't have a D2C offering, really. That's why they're looking to work with the, you know, the Tescas and the Asdas of this world. But they can still use the limited data that they have and, you know, build lookalikes, overlay machine learning, and scale that way as well. So there are ways to do it. Of I guess if you are a smaller client or a client that has a limited amount of first-party data.
And it's quite interesting, actually, that you raised that point around retail media, Phil, because we've been having lots of other related conversations about the opportunity for those brands that don't have big amounts of first-party data, use those what would have been perhaps in-store marketing budgets to divert to potential, you know, advertising opportunities in retail media environment, right? So going to, you know, e-commerce sites or third-party sellers of their products and using that as an opportunity to try to build out your data sets and data segments. You know, of course, no doubt there's much conversation between everybody involved in that as to what data will be accessible and, you know, and what those brands can legitimately expect. But it's a really interesting space, right?
Yeah, absolutely agree. It's a really exciting space. It's going to get bigger. As well, but you know, it's not hard. It's easy to say build a retail media proposition, but it's not easy to build.
Well,
I think ASOS have been working on theirs for, you know, 12 months. You know, don't quote me on that, but it's been a while. And you know, it's about building those internal teams, understanding what you can get from your data sets as well, having the technology to underpin that. It's, you know, it's a journey.
Yeah. And Danny, can you say a little bit about then, you know, because part of what you're doing at Ozone obviously is offering the ability, I suppose, for publishers to not just make use of their own first-party data, but also kind of grow, in effect, their data assets by being able to access other data sets via a sort of a unified login. Are you, you know, are you coming across smaller publishers that are wanting to get a piece of the action, and to what extent are you able to support them?
Yeah, there's a great deal of interest in, I suppose, the Ozone proposition from a publisher perspective. So lots of interest from publishers. I think there's recognition, you know, it's marketers that are demanding, you know, scaled, streamlined access to targeting. I think that's recognised by small to medium-sized publishers as well as the largest publishers. And I think there's a point of context there, right, which is, you know, there's a gulf between you know, a publisher, you know, it's kind of in the, you know, the bottom end of the ComScore 100 versus the top end of the ComScore 100. But the entire of the UK publisher ecosystem is tiny compared to the US market. And so, you know, scale is a real, real challenge. And I suppose that is, you know, one of the reasons, again, you know, we've invested in creating scaled solutions that support marketers, execute or leverage publisher assets. And we've looked at that through two kind of related lenses. You've got identity resolution. We felt it critically important that publishers own their identity. Secondly, the curation of audience behaviours that hang off that identity as well. That's working well. You know, it's providing means for marketers to you know, to buy into quality environments with ease, and to realise you know, strong return on investments as a result, whether they're after, you know, branding outcomes or performance outcomes.
I'd like to just sort of touch on again the degree to which I suppose the industry feels prepared for getting their heads around these new buying environments, particularly private gardens. And I guess I want to start from the marketer's perspective. To what extent, Matt, do you feel that other colleagues, other marketing colleagues of yours, perhaps, you know, at other organisations, feel sort of up to speed and kind of, you know, with industry changes and sort of equipped to get to grips with what they need to know to make some big decisions, frankly, within their business about the ways in which they're going to change their advertising and marketing practices?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a couple of ways to look at this. So I mean, sort of simplistically, I think everyone is aware that there's an impact coming. And I think everyone, you know, there's two ways of looking at it. You can look at it from a you know, the refreshing point of view of things are changing, you could come out of this in a much better position than we went into it. And we should have, you know, in terms of how we manage customer data, ideally everything is set up as it should be from that point of view as an advertiser. And it's just navigating the various changes to measurement and everything else that comes with what's going on this year. But I think then there's another part to it as well for a lot of brands that is, you know, that's the simplistic view. And that's probably the view that everyone in the brand has. Okay, there's going to be change. We know there's going to be impact. And then levels underneath that sort of are then preserved only for performance marketing teams or teams closest to media buy-in, closest to agencies if they're working with external partners, or obviously the buy-in teams within brands themselves. And I think that's where there's a real education piece to be done from those teams to within the business, so that, you know, when this first happened, there was a lot of information out there. Everyone had an opinion. Oftentimes it wasn't always the right information. It took a lot to decipher. There was agendas involved and various other bits. I think that it's probably important from a marketer and a brand point of view, certainly from my point of view, to make sure that when we're ahead of it, so everyone in the business is engaged in the conversations, they're aware of the impacts that are coming and all the various changes that need to be made, because they run far beyond my team. So they'll run into dev teams and data controller teams and all the rest of it. But also just informing the top level of the business. And even you mentioned this word last time we spoke, Rachel, about almost having a champion or a sponsor at that level of the business, so that the sort of anything that is read is outside of what's talked about internally is seen through the right lens and through a lens of education, as opposed to just being a scare tactic and various other pieces. And I guess as well, from a best practice point of view, we need to, as marketers, we need to get as far ahead of this as possible, because we don't want to get to a point where there are detrimental impacts to the things we're doing and then we're almost using this as an excuse. I think the most important thing is transparency within the business as well as to what all of this means, how it's going to impact the way we buy on a daily, weekly basis, how it's going to potentially impact performance, etc. And I think there's definitely a role to play with partners again on in that respect. I think I've certainly benefited from having conversations with as many people as possible. This in itself is another part of that education piece for me, you know, being joined by you guys, because really it's just these things are changing so drastically. Decks that I've written are becoming outdated pretty quickly. So I think it's about keeping your ear to the ground as much as possible, from certainly from an advertising and brand point of view, and then feeding that back into the people who can help you navigate.
And do you find that's reflected in other parts of the industry, both Danny and Phil? Like, I mean, you know, rowing back years, you're a bit of a veteran in the industry, Danny, not in age, obviously, just in experience. But do you feel like, because you mentioned earlier on that the demand for sort of closer relationships with publishers is being driven by marketers, do you feel like that's becoming more commonplace? Marketers are becoming more aware of what they need to know. You know, the levels of education have improved and people are becoming quite proactive.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's beginning to be used in a different way, perhaps the way it was originally intended. I think, you know, where programmatic technology very quickly penetrated the buying market and ultimately kind of distributed swathes of spend across the long tail of the internet, i.e. fundamentally changed the media that was being bought. You wouldn't have seen ads on Breitbart until such point that spend was being executed by a bidder. The planner would have been sacked. I think we're beginning to see greater selectivity and the return of planning in many ways, although it goes through a different process. But I think that, you know, to follow on from what Matt said, the change that we're facing in our market, everyone's clear that something fundamental announced it's about to change, but I'm not sure that the path forward and what people need to do about it is yet clear across the board. And I think that is, again, without sort of dwelling on the point, it's, you know, you can articulate through that through the reality check, right? We're still talking about what happens when third party cookies have disappeared. They've gone, guys. Less than 50% of your audience is addressable today. And you know, if you're using a DSP and a DMP, i.e. you're dependent on third-party cookies twice over, your addressability is probably 25% at best. So you're missing most of the opportunity today. And I'm not sure the market has widely grasped that concept. This is still seen to be an issue down the track. I think the good news is that things are going to change. I think as behaviours change and as publishers and marketers re-engage with each other after a decade of having not spoken, and with a shakeout in terms of complexity, right? The supply chain is incredibly complex. It's not going to look like that in a couple of years' time. Because of the pressure these changes put on, some of the players in the market. So that's not to say innovation won't happen, others will emerge, but I think it's going to take a little while for the market to become clear as to kind of what the path looks like. But I think you've kind of hit the nail on the head in terms of the headlines, Rachel, which is, primary actors, buyers and publishers, first-party data owners, needing to re-engage and build dialogue, because that is the way they'll be able to create value for one another build meaningful transactions.
Phil, does that feel like a good synopsis? Is that, from a sort of technology point of view, and part of what you guys are doing at Media Rhythmics is obviously trying to support buyers in particular to sort of, like we described earlier, navigate their way around a variety of tech solutions and the complexities of buying environments. I suppose two things: are people waking up to the fundamental reality that Danny described, which is we can't use the same tools that we've been using forever because they don't work anymore? And then within that, are you feeling as though the fundamental basis is driving the industry, which is buyers and sellers want to be a little more clear between one another what they're buying and selling?
It's hard as a marketer, I think, and we sit on the tech side thinking it's easy for a marketer to decide what type of platform to use in this space. But then if you just look at the number of companies in the CDP space, for example, which I guess we're part of, you're talking about maybe thousands of companies, right? And they're all saying the same thing with slightly different nuance. So it's difficult for marketers to actually cut through and actually understand what is going to be, the platform that's going to suit their needs. So I empathize with them. It's difficult. On the third party cookie piece, from my perspective, potentially brands and publishers maybe aren't moving as quickly as what I would have expected. As Danny said, the third-party cookie is effectively gone. It's going. It's going to happen. Businesses need to plan for that. And I thought it would be slightly quicker. Probably what you'll see is maybe after the summer, maybe brands start to, drive that conversation, forwards, I guess, as we move into the back end of 2021, ready for 2022. And then to your third point around, I guess, brands working more closely with publishers, I think, private gardens, the whole point of this podcast is talking about private gardens, I guess, and they're becoming more prevalent because clients need to work with publishers from a first-party data point of view generally within a private garden. That brings up, points around legal and privacy. And it's easier for a brand and a publisher to have that direct communication without, an intermediary in the middle. So, we are definitely seeing that merge of those relationships happening in the space today.
Matt, the other thing that I'm wondering as well is, you mentioned earlier that it's important to you to find an alternative beyond some of the walled gardens. So that's one of the reasons why a private garden environment is attractive to you. And I think you've also mentioned before that, particularly at a brand like Three, your customers are potentially everyone. So it's incumbent upon you to find audiences wherever they might be. Does that, do you think, it might depend on what brand a marketer is working for, but do you think marketers truly understand the potential of audiences outside existing walled gardens?
Yeah, so I mean, to Phil and Danny's points, we've already moved away from, you know, our buying has changed as a result of what we're seeing in open marketplaces, etc. Certainly the marketers that I've spoken to, there is an awareness. I think they, you know, there's an appreciation that this is an adjustment and this is a change. And for some marketers and brands, that's potentially uncomfortable moving away from what they know and the norm and the ease of working with certain partners that they're familiar with and everything set up and various other pieces to that. And also there's the fact that, you know, for us as well as a brand, we've spent years fine-tuning performance and there's various other pieces of attribution at play and various changes that a lot of brands have made over the last couple of years. And I know, you know, it's a real pain point to have to change and to have to start again in some respects with certain things and to potentially rip up, you know, plenty of work that's gone into getting to a position that brands are in at the moment. But at the same time, I don't think any marketer can say they're not aware of what's going on. There's certainly plenty of noise about it. And from my point of view, there's certainly plenty of great resource available to, you know, make informed decisions. And to, I think Danny, yeah, really sort of nailed it in terms of that meaningful transaction. I think that's what it comes down to. And ultimately, if you're moving away, like I said earlier, we can potentially come out of this, if you're open-minded enough, in a far better position from a performance point of view. And to your point, Rachel, I think it's just about being open-minded to the fact that there are plenty of opportunities. You can't just sort of default to a certain number of players. But certainly from the conversations I've had in various roundtables and some of the sort of just keeping in touch with peers across the industry, there's certainly an awareness that there's plenty of places to go to mitigate the impact that is heading our way. So I don't think anyone could be naive to that fact.
I think if I ask this question, it might open up a whole other potential, you know, podcast topic. But you mentioned, you know, concerns around the ways in which perhaps some brands might be wedded to working because they've been doing it for a long time, and presumably measurement and attribution will be aligned to that. To what extent do you worry about that in this kind of fast-changing landscape?
I feel fully aware of it, and it's challenging. Certainly, we as a business, it took us a long time to move away from last click. It took us, you know, a while to get kind of metrics in order and various other pieces that go with it. It's a scary thought to lose what has been built previously, and to any sort of impact on attribution is a scary thought from a media buying point of view, because obviously we're trying to feed back as much information as possible into the business as to why we're making the decisions we are, and something that gives us a view of multi-touch attribution certainly helps make that case for why our media money is spent where it is and across the channels it is. So certainly there's an appreciation and awareness, and obviously it's not a frustration, but there is a challenge ahead. We certainly understand that things need to change, and it's inevitable, right? So, I mean, we can all sort of moan about it, or we can get on with it and find a solution,
and accept that things have changed already, as Danny says.
Absolutely, right. And I think that's probably the key point is for a lot of people is that appreciation for the changes here. And I think this is similar to when GDPR first rolled around. There was almost this panic. You know, a lot of people just sat there and said, well, we'll take care of that when it kicks in. I think this is certainly one of those things where they you can be a long way through the journey. I feel like we're lucky at Three that I'm lucky to be surrounded by people who have been engaged in these conversations, and there is an awareness of it. But yes, certainly anyone listening who thinks, you know, they've put a date in the calendar of when this is going to switch over and someone's going to give them a call and say, okay, you need to change now. That's certainly not going to happen.
Yes. Maybe a better strategy to get ahead of the game. Danny.
Rachel, point of view on that. I think there's an analogy with the investment market, right? We're talking about media investment, and, you know, what we're approaching is a point, what we're talking about is a significant restructuring and reorganization of our market. So you're talking about market volatility, right? And I think, you know, through moments like this, or approaching moments like this, your portfolio approach only becomes more important, which is, you know, understanding the different ways in which you can invest, understanding how they perform, in relative terms. I've done a fair bit of buying myself. I'm not an expert, as some are, as Matt is. But the test and learn frameworks that, you know, many buyers and agents and buyers have told me about, which is, you know, always having a part of your budget associated with testing, and therefore never becoming dependent on your core strategy, feels really, really key at a time like this. And especially when we're not sure exactly how things are going to land and how things are going to shake out. I think there's opportunity out there for those that are testing and learning.
Yeah. Phil, what's your point of view on that? Is there, do you think, you know, the sort of private garden environment sort of helps guide people's minds towards, diversity of opportunity? Is it also an environment where marketers can be perhaps a little more, confident to spend money in places that they haven't before?
Yeah, I think, look, it's another option. Matt mentioned the G word, I guess. You know, we've already mentioned Facebook, and I think in the UK that's, 70% of ad spend at the moment, around about that level. It's another option. It's diversification in terms of ad spend and potentially performance. There's a lot of, media owners and publishers that have some really great propositions out in the market as well that is different to what those platforms provide, the walled gardens. And they're providing more transparency around really important things that buyers want to see fundamentally from a campaign perspective. So, I think it's actually really exciting for if you're a brand and, you know, you've got this opportunity to, as Danny said, test and learn and not just rely on the core strategy. I think it's really exciting to have those opportunities in the market.
I think a few important things came out of our discussion. The industry changes, which we now talk about on a daily basis concerning tracking and targeting, have already happened, and we're in the midst of a big industry shift. That marketers are by and large hungry for any advice and guidance they can get from trusted parties, and that the industry as a whole has a role to play in creating that trusted environment, whether it's by partnering directly with or supporting brands and publishers, or whether it's by building the right tools to make better advertising transactions possible. A huge thank you to Matt, Danny, and Phil for the contributions. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Thanks for listening.